and welcome to a special edition of Midori House, live from Argo Studios in Chelsea, New York City, with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Jonathan Openshaw.
On today's programme, we speak to Phil Warber of Reuters to get a rundown of the latest movements in American retail after the traditional post-Thanksgiving boom.
And as American Airlines files for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, we'll be on the line to the company's home state of Texas to speak to Terry Maxson of Dallas Morning News about how the story is unfolding.
And we'll also be giving you a taste of last night's launch event of Monocle's Denmark survey in Washington, D.C., where we spoke to the Danish ambassador about the country's role in the world.
All that, plus a special New York mix of the best music, right here on Midori House, live from New York, on Monocle 24. So welcome, everyone, to New York City and the rather stunning studios we're in today, aren't they, Jonathan?
I know, these are great, aren't they? They're rivaling Midori House for coziness.
It is. Yeah, cozy is the thing you'd say. It's very nice, lots of sort of soft furnishings.
Some pattern rugs.
There are some pattern rugs. And some mood lighting.
Mood lighting, just for you and me, Steve.
Exactly. Very different from Washington yesterday, which was all strip lighting and...
And only a block away from my hotel this time, so we can't have too much taxi strife.
Yes, it won't be a struggle for us to get back. We've got an awful lot to pack in, as ever, but until then, we're going to cross over now to London for the latest news from around the world with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Iranian protesters briefly took six British embassy staff hostage today when they stormed two diplomatic compounds in Tehran, smashing windows, hurling petrol bombs and burning the British flag in a protest against sanctions imposed by Britain. Britain said it was outraged by the attacks on its embassy compound, but had no immediate comment on the seizure of its staff, who Iran's semi-official Faris news agency said were freed by police later. And we've just heard that the protest at the British compound in Tehran has ended and students have left the embassy. Turkey said today it did not want military intervention in Syria, but was ready for any scenario to deal with President Bashar al-Assad's violent crackdown on popular unrest, including setting up a buffer zone to contain any mass influx of refugees. The United Nations has accused President Assad's government of murdering and torturing hundreds of children during the unrest. UN panel chairman Paulo Pinheiro says they were seemingly carried out with little remorse.
Torture, sexual violence and ill-treatment were inflicted on civilians suspected of sympathy with the protests, regardless of their gender or age.
French Foreign Minister Alain Juppé says Syria is heading for a humanitarian crisis and the EU, Arab League and Turkey must work together on how to deliver aid. The last of the trucks carrying supplies for NATO forces in Afghanistan were turned back from the Pakistan-Afghan border today as Pakistan clamped down on the supply route in retaliation for a NATO airstrike on Pakistani military outposts over the weekend. The Norwegian mass killer Anders Behring Breivik may avoid jail but end up in a psychiatric institution indefinitely after court-appointed experts concluded he is criminally insane. In Norway's worst attack since World War II, Breivik killed 77 people in July by bombing central Oslo and then gunning down dozens of mostly teenagers at a summer camp of the ruling Labour Party's youth wing. Norway has a tradition of stressing rehabilitation of criminals rather than punishment, but one politician called the report incomprehensible. Egyptians continue to vote today in a parliamentary election that Islamists hope will sweep them closer to power, even though the army generals who took over from President Hosni Mubarak have yet to step aside. The election, the first since a revolt ousted Mubarak on February the 11th, unfolded without the mayhem many had feared after last week's riots against army rule in which 42 people were killed. Tim Marshall is in Cairo.
What looks to be a relatively high turnout is encouraging, and it shows that there's an awful lot of people who are prepared to give the process a chance. It doesn't mean that everybody trusts the process, doesn't mean that everybody trusts the army to oversee this process, but they are giving it a go.
A leading opposition challenger to Democratic Republic of Congo's President Joseph Kabila has called for the Central African state's elections to be annulled, accusing authorities of systematic fraud. And Nigeria's Senate has passed a bill to criminalise gay marriage and any same-sex, what he termed amorous relationship, a major step in putting in place a law that has drawn widespread criticism in Western countries. The Senate increased the punishment for gay marriage from the 5 years imprisonment originally proposed in the draft bill to 14 years. The legislation must be passed by the House of Representatives and signed by President Goodluck Jonathan before it becomes law. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks a lot, Nick. And now over to the global weather with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
And first up is Europe. The northern half of the continent is entering quite a stormy period. Over the next 5 to 10 days, the jet stream will send high winds and heavy rain across the UK, Germany and Scandinavia. Typical turbulent autumn weather for this climate. Wednesday itself is looking okay in London, all the while much of the Mediterranean sunny. Here's Wednesday's city forecast then. In London, 12 degrees, windy and cloudy. In Amsterdam, 10 Celsius, a few clouds here. Zurich, 7 degrees, partly cloudy. In Rome, 15 Celsius and sunny. And over to North America, a wet Tuesday afternoon across the northeast of the US and the eastern seaboard, soggy in Washington, D.C. However, the clouds should break and allow for some sunshine on Wednesday. Meanwhile, most of the US is enjoying good weather, especially the central states and the Pacific coast. So Wednesday's city forecast. In New York City, 11 Celsius, sun and a few showers. In Chicago, 5 Celsius and sunny, and snow flurries here later in the week. Miami, 23 degrees and sunny. And in San Diego, it's 17 Celsius and sunny. Asia Pacific now. South Korea is looking wet on Wednesday, and some of the cloud and rain will also reach Japan, mainly the western side of Honshu, so Tokyo on the eastern side is looking fine. Here's Wednesday's city outlook. Seoul, 6 Celsius and rain. In Tokyo, it's 16 and partly cloudy. Shanghai, 12 Celsius and cloudy. In Hong Kong, 25 and sunny. And a quick look at Australia. Thunderstorms on Wednesday across Victoria and New South Wales. Thursday, the thundery weather will reach the Gold Coast and Brisbane. That's it. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Thomas. It is 1:07 here in New York. You're listening to Midori House.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 i Yorkosa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24, and welcome back to Midori House, which isn't actually coming to you from Midori House in Marylebone, but from Argo Studios in New York.
Now, the big news in America today is the announcement from the country's third largest carrier, American Airlines. They'll be filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. In some ways, this should come as no surprise to anyone, after years of labour strife and spiralling overheads. And yet, the implications for the industry are potentially huge. To give us an insight into the unfolding situation, we're joined on the line from Dallas, home of American Airlines, by Terry Maxim from the Dallas Morning News, who's been covering the story. Terry, thanks very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you indeed. American Airlines say that they're going to be operating normally despite this, but do you think this could be the beginning of the end for American Airlines?
No, I don't think so. They have a lot of strengths, and even with their huge losses over recent years, they retain those strengths. It is probably as they have stated, that they need to get their cost in line with what other airlines, most of whom have gone through this same process and lowered their cost in bankruptcy, have to get them in line so that they can compete on a more even playing field. Employees aren't going to like this, of course, because their pay will be affected, their working conditions will change, their benefits will probably be reduced. New employees certainly will not get pensions, but it's a bit of tough medicine that's probably inevitable.
Well, as you say, you know, Delta and United have both been through a fairly similar process. Do you think they're both looking a lot healthier now, sort of on the other side?
Well, you know, if you look at the profit figures for the U.S. airline industry right now, nearly every airline is profitable. Right now, American is very much the exception. While American will probably lose about $1.2 million in 2011, Delta is in the hundreds of millions in profits. United, Continental, hundreds of millions of dollars in profits. Just about everybody's making money. American is really all alone in not doing so.
It's Jonathan here in the studio with Steve. I was just wondering. There's a sense that the glory days of American air travel are long behind American Airlines, and they've really been kind of limping on for most of the noughties. Do you think there's a more pervasive problem than just these, you know, the labour tensions and the overheads, that actually there's a problem with competing with offers, you know, particularly in Asia, but even in Europe, and that actually the standard of service just isn't there anymore?
it is a problem that they have to address, a perception that particularly in the premium class that they do not offer as good a product, certainly of what the non-U.S. carriers provide. American's very much counting on its alliance with British Airways and Iberia on your side of the Atlantic, with Japan Airlines, with Cathay Pacific and Qantas across the Pacific, to be its international arm. We don't know what American will do. It's got an order of long haul Boeing 777s, and it will be getting the new Boeing 787 in the next few years. And that will allow it to stretch its international reach, but we don't know what they'll be able to do. Certainly, I think most U.S. carriers are trying to put a focus on providing a better service for their first class and business class people, because they are really the ones that make the profit for the airlines.
Hmm. And obviously American Airlines is a huge national brand with roots going back to the 1930s, and these roots go back to Texas, Houston itself. So how's it being received, you know, as a man who's working and watching the Texan aviation industry? What's the mood like in Houston at the moment?
Well, what we hear from customers, it's kind of a business as usual. American, as the other airlines who filed for bankruptcy, has been quick to reassure them that their frequent flyer miles are safe, their tickets will be honored. If they need refunds, they're going to get their money back. Their flights will not be canceled. Their schedule will be maintained. They, in fact, intend to maintain their basic business strategy of focusing it on what they call five cornerstones, and not cut the service. Inevitably, an airline that goes through Chapter 11 bankruptcy proceedings will trim out the things that it cannot make money doing. So I think we'll see American come out on the other side of this probably, I would guess, in the first half of 2013, maybe the last part of 2012, if they can really push through something with a lot more modern fleet as they park the older, inefficient airplanes. With a sleeker schedule, but probably not decimated from what it is today. American Airlines is, in fact, much smaller than it was 10 years ago. It has shrunk employees, it has shrunk airplanes. So the shrinkage may have already occurred. They have said that the labor cost issue was really the last part of their strategic turnaround, and the rest of it, plane renewal, schedule restructuring, network rationalization, they think they've already done.
Terry, looking at this slightly more broadly, do you think that the big traditional American airlines like American, Delta, United and so on have what it takes to take on the might of the Asian giants?
That's a good question. One thing that helps the U.S. carriers is the U.S. domestic market is a very big market. And that can help feed an international route system. On the other hand, the domestic picture in the United States is dominated by lower cost carriers. Southwest Airlines, a good example, but also JetBlue and newcomers like Virgin America. And so they're really being pressed on their average fares in the United States. So, as opposed to, say, a Singapore Airlines has, of course, virtually no domestic feed for their flights. It is all international passengers virtually. Delta, American, United, U.S. Airways will have a significant amount of domestic feed to go to their international carriers. But there is certainly a sense that a domestic full-service carrier is perhaps an anachronism in today's markets. You'll see that U.S. carriers like American and Delta increasingly become international, and then they put themselves in the gun sights of the high-quality carriers like Emirates, Kuwait, Qantas, British Airways, and you name it.
Mm. And obviously it's early days for this story, and there's an element of breaking news here and watching it unfold. But what are your predictions for how we might see the story develop in the coming days? I mean, I believe the workers' unions have just made a statement, and there's a sense that this is a bit of an internal battle with American Airlines between management and workers. What do you think, what are we going to see coming next?
Well, of course, I have a parochial interest in it, and that there are tens of thousands of American employees who live in my home market, and this on one side will not be good news for them. They're going to pay more for their benefits. They'll probably have to work more hours. On the other hand, nobody likes to work for a losing company, and I'm sure the employees of American are very tired of losing. You do not want to read every quarter how many hundreds of millions of dollars your employer has made. Mm. Can't invest in you, can't invest in your airplanes if you don't make money. So if you're going to hit bottom, I presume there is something to be said for finally hitting bottom so you can start going up. Mm. So from that standpoint, I've heard from employees who say they don't like this, they understand why it's happened, and they just want to get it over with and get started on whatever that new world will be.
Terry Maxim from the Dallas Morning News, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Monocle 24. Time now for our first song. This is Sutphin Boulevard by New York City's very own Blood Orange.
That was Sutphin Boulevard by Blood Orange. You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Jonathan Openshaw, coming to you today from New York.
Yes, New York.
Indeed. Yeah, someone had to say that at some stage, didn't they?
And from Washington, D.C. yesterday.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. We've been up and down on Amtrak, haven't we?
We have. There's been a bit of Amtrak action every day. It's at the 7 o'clock.
It was for a good reason to go down to Washington.
There was. It wasn't just to do... Just to do the shows.
Just to do shows.
I don't know, there was a good reason to. We were in Washington, D.C. yesterday for the launch of our Denmark survey.
Which we've got a package coming up later in the show.
Yes, a very interesting report from that party last night.
It's a good party though, wasn't it?
It was. It was this sort of good mix of diplomats and lots of men in uniform as well, lots of defence attachés.
Yeah, defence attachés, business leaders. My favourite was the concrete magnate.
Yes.
From one of the oldest concrete dynasties in the United States.
Yeah, concrete has been in his family for three generations. He's wondering, he's sort of looking around, sort of cities going, yeah, built that.
It's funny, there was this huge sense of pride in the kind of reshaping America. And it's true, I mean, of industries you can work in, few can have left more of an indelible mark than concrete.
Indeed. Well, yes, quite literally.
Shaped the cities.
Yes.
But no, it's great. And Ray LaHood was there.
Yes,
a friend of ours,
U.S. Transportation Secretary, who was good, and lots of other sort of D.C. types,
and just amazing setting as well.
It
1960s
is.
Villa, which is incredible, I think.
It is the embassy itself is on a quite a cool street as well. It's right opposite Bill and Hillary Clinton's house.
It is,
which had hardly any security outside, or not that you could see anyway. It's almost like you could just knock on the door.
And just off Ambassador's Row, which is that incredible. Well, apparently the Danish embassy actually kicked off that whole movement where countries started to kind of show the embassy became a showcase of their best design. So in 1960, Denmark was one of the first countries to build the modern embassy, and now you've got that entire row where everyone's got. It's almost folly-like, isn't it? The designs, competing designs.
It is, but a lot of them are sort of trying to show, this is who we are and this is what the country is, and some like the Danish and the Japanese are great, and some like Ivory Coast and Chad. You think, that's where all the money went. Interesting. But anyway, we're going to be hearing more from that sort of towards the end of the program.
Yes. Time for our next package now, though, I think. So earlier today, our senior editor, Sophie Grove, spoke to Isabel Coleman, a senior fellow and director at the Civil Society Markets and Democracy Initiative at the Council on Foreign Relations. She started by asking her how US policy has changed since the seismic shifts in the Middle East.
Well, the place where you're seeing, of course, the most rapid change and unpredictable change and seismic shifts is in the Middle East. You've had an old order which has been upended by the Arab uprisings. Regimes that have been in place for decades have been swept away, and it's not at all clear what's going to take their place. But we do know that the old order is gone, and we're in for some very turbulent times.
And Isabel, to what extent do you think that Obama's reticence and sort of his anti-interventionist policies have rehabilitated sort of reputation in the Middle East?
Well, I think it's debatable whether he's been anti-interventionist. After all, the United States did intervene in Libya, and the United States has, despite overtures made early in the Obama administration to try to reach out and to Iran and put U.S.-Iranian relations on a better footing. You've seen, in fact, a retreat to the status quo ante of a very, you know, hostile relationship again with talk of crippling economic sanctions. You've seen a dramatic uptick in drone attacks in Yemen, in Pakistan. So to say that he has not been interventionist, I think is, you know, he's had quite a muscular foreign policy, of course, in Afghanistan has increased the troop levels there, even as he's withdrawn from Iraq. So it's been a mixture of more globalist rhetoric, but some very interventionist, unilaterally interventionist policies in different ways. So it's I think, overall, the difference between the Obama foreign policy and the Bush foreign policy is not as great as one might think, just looking at the rhetoric.
Europe is seen as the natural ally to the US, but how have the European economic problems and crises really been putting strain on that relationship?
Well, the strain, I think, has been on the economic front. You've seen it play out in a number of different ways with Obama and the Obama administration urging a much more aggressive response to the global economic crisis and to the euro crisis than European governments have taken. You've seen it on a security alliance front where, you know, there have been a lot of head shaking in the United States about Europe's inability to project force in a country like Libya because of significant defense cutbacks. So I think you're going to see it in a number of different ways. There is a lot of concern, of course, on the economic front and what's happening in Europe. But you know, we have our own economic problems here. So where the answers are going to come from on the economic front is still very unclear.
And finally, Isabel, can I just ask you one more question about Obama's presence in Asia? I mean, we've seen a shift towards the sort of Asia-Pacific region. How realistic is this new alliance, and how much do you think it's a kind of distraction from some of the things that he'd rather not dwell on?
Well, I think it's, I think it is a reflection of the fact that the United States has had an overwhelming focus in the Middle East in the last decade. With the invasion of Afghanistan, followed shortly by the invasion of Iraq, you know, you have seen so much money, blood, treasure, mind share going towards that greater Middle East region. And as, you know, the United States draws down in Iraq and begins to draw down in Afghanistan, that will inevitably change, and it already is changing. And I think with the dramatic changes that are taking place in the Middle East, you will see a lot of diplomatic attention focused there, but a recognition that our leverage is actually quite limited in some of these countries. What is happening is beyond the control of the United States. And Asia, in contrast, seems somewhat more predictable environment. You have long-term allies there that are interested in a re-engaged United States, certainly as a counterbalance to rising China. And I think you've seen the United States, in recognition of the dramatic economic growth of that region, that, you know, we continue to downplay it at our own peril. And so I do think it's realistic to see more of a shift to the Asia region in terms of American foreign policy.
That was Monocle's senior editor, Sophie Grove, talking to Isabel Coleman from the Council for Foreign Relations.
We're going to play another song now, and again, it's got a New York theme. This is Billy Joel with Miami 2017, I've Seen the Lights Go Out on Broadway.
Seen the lights go out on Broadway.
That was Billy Joel. In the next half hour on Midori House on Monocle 24 from New York, we'll be talking to Reuters' Phil Wahber about the US retail market. But first, it's back to London for the latest headlines with Nick Kelly.
Thanks, Steve. The British Foreign Secretary said Iran faces serious consequences after protesters stormed two British embassy compounds in Tehran, and that he has protested in the strongest terms to Iran's foreign minister. The Far East news agency in Tehran has said that the protest is over and students have left the embassy compound. Turkey said today it did not want military intervention in Syria, but was ready for any scenario to deal with President Bashar al-Assad's violent crackdown on popular unrest. The last of the trucks carrying supplies for NATO forces in Afghanistan were turned back from the Pakistan-Afghan border today as Pakistan pulled out of an international conference on the future of Afghanistan. The Norwegian mass killer Anders Behring Breivik may avoid jail but end up in a psychiatric institution indefinitely after court-appointed experts concluded he is criminally insane. American Airlines and its parent company AMR filed for bankruptcy today after failing to win a labour deal with pilots and suffering from mounting fuel costs. Egyptians continue to vote today in a parliamentary election that Islamists hope will sweep them closest to power, even though the army generals who took over from President Mubarak have yet to step aside. A leading opposition challenger to Democratic Republic of Congo's President Joseph Kabila has called for the Central African state's elections to be annulled, accusing authorities of systematic fraud. Nigeria's Senate has passed a bill to criminalise gay marriage and any same-sex, what it termed amorous relationship, a major step in putting in place a law that has drawn widespread criticism in Western countries. Russia's President Dmitry Medvedev visited a radar station in the country's western enclave Kaliningrad today, saying the station was meant for the United States and NATO after an announcement that Russia would ramp up its early warning radar to protect its nuclear missile sites. And for the first time, tax evaders in Greece, including high-profile individuals and businessmen of prominent companies, are being arrested one after the other and forced to pay the money they owe the state or face jail. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Nick. You're listening to Midori House live today from New York.
Now, America's just open season on the post-Thanksgiving shopping frenzy that leads up to Christmas, so today seems a good moment to take stock and talk retail. With us in the studio today, we have Reuters journalist Phil Wahber, who covers everything from department stores to booksellers. Phil, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So I guess the big question now is, obviously, there was a kind of artificial injection last Friday. How can retailers sustain this boom over the next weeks?
Well, it was a really strong Black Friday, but it was fueled by discounts. We're not out of the woods. The economy is still not good. Gas prices are still high. Unemployment is still high. So what people are expecting is that retailers are going to keep trotting out deals for the next 5 weeks and good deals to get shoppers to keep shopping. They've been trained by the bad economy and by mobile to be looking for deals. So if anybody thinks that they can take their foot off the gas and start charging people full price, they might be disappointed.
Mm. And obviously they were successful in whipping up quite a frenzy last week. Like you said, there was that story of the woman in Walmart using pepper spray to get her hands on an Xbox, which is remarkable. What kind of tricks are you seeing? Is there a more innovative approach to retail that's emerging now?
Well, honestly, it was just a lot of discounts. You know, the way they got the deals, they made people aware of the deals was more innovative. You know, there's a lot of mobile instant coupons. But, you know, they were sort of helped by the good weather. A lot of people are skeptical about what this means. There was not a single weather disruption in this enormous country, which really is rare. So people went out. It's part of the culture, part of the sport. So with still 4 weeks to go, the jury's still out.
You say discounts played a major role. What time of year normally in the run-up to Christmas and the holiday season do shops start to bring out these sort of discounts? Was this unusually early?
No, it was. Well, actually, it was earlier than usual. In fact, you can say that the holiday shopping season started for some retailers as early as late September. You had Walmart and you had Toys R Us that were doing layaway programs. Nobody's taking any risks this year. Shoppers are not ready to waste money, and it's an all-out battle. I mean, I don't think we're going to see a very strong overall pie rise. In fact, the National Retail Federation still thinks that retail sales will be up 2.8 to 3% more than last year, which is barely more than inflation. So if I were a retailer, I wouldn't be breaking out the party hats just yet.
And is this good old-fashioned flash sales? Are people queuing up outside shops, or are you seeing a corresponding online boom?
Oh, the online was very strong as well. On Cyber Monday, we saw it was rising 15% on Cyber Monday, but it was a nice follow through. You know, the National Retail Federation found that over the weekend sales were up 16.4%, and that was really up and down.
Mm. And obviously, New York markets typified by some very strong department store brands, and also the luxury retailers. I mean, everyone's here. What are you seeing at the top end of the market?
Well, Black Friday is not nearly as big a deal for luxury as Black Friday is, because the wealthy don't really need deals as much.
They don't need the discounts as much.
Right. I mean, or they see it sort of as beneath them. You know, you'd
not sent to pepper spray.
No. Well, I mean, I don't know about you, but I would pepper spray somebody over a fine. Well, I wouldn't, but I might think of it for that fine cashmere sweater at Saks. But you know, it's never that big a deal for them. They still want to get people in the stores. But for example, you know, there was this rush of at Macy's and others to open at midnight, but Nordstrom stuck with its usual hours, and so did Saks. So, you know, the wealthy are brought in through different means and deals.
And are you finding that at the luxury end of the market, a lot of these retailers are actually surviving quite well despite the depressed economy?
Well, what's really weird is you'd think in theory with, it's now been what, about 4 or 5 months that we're getting daily headlines about the European problem, the debt problem here. Nobody can agree on how to solve it. Unemployment's not going anywhere. The stock market goes up and down 3% every day, it seems. And yet, people still turn out. You know, you had, there was some softness. both Saks and Nordstrom reported sales that disappointed Wall Street in October. But that followed very strong earlier months, and they are all, in fact, forecasting sales gains this holiday season.
Hmm. Now, obviously, we're staying with the luxury sector. Obviously, a major force in it is international spending from the likes of Russia and China and Brazil. I think China increased spending was up 39% in New York last year. So, you pointed us towards this story about the some regulators asking for a relaxation of visa rules for these countries. Can you tell us a bit more about the background to that?
In May, we had a group of CEOs from some of the top luxury chains come to the Reuters offices, and one after the other, Coach, Saks, Neiman Marcus, all talked about how difficult it is for wealthy tourists from Russia, China, and Brazil in particular to get visas to come to this country. So a lot of them were preferring to go do their luxury shopping in places like London and Paris. And these executives were saying, we want a piece of that. I mean, if you look at it, the Saks store here on Fifth Avenue is 20% of that chain's sales, and it has 53 stores in all. And of that 20%, you know, you've got about a quarter that comes from international tourists. You know, same thing at the Tiffany. Tiffany that reported its quarterly results today. And sales at the U.S. store here, at the big flagship store on Fifth Avenue, were up 24%. And they said that was really because of international tourism. So these chains are saying, we want a piece of that too. So can you let in more of these tourists? And, you know, you can see very easily at the Saks in Miami, half of the business there is Venezuelan and South American tourists. So they just want more of it.
Hmm. And you mentioned other global shopping cities there. You mentioned Paris and London. And obviously, stores like Harrods in London, propped up to an extent by Chinese and Russian spending, and the Galeries Lafayette in Paris similarly. So I'm interested in the Brazilian luxury market and whether that's the kind of goal for New York. Because obviously, the luxury market in Brazil is very interesting. The extra kind of taxes on import means that the luxury goods there are actually three times the price that you can get in international cities, and yet the people who are buying these goods are footloose; they can shop anywhere. So, do you think that is Brazil a market to look at? Do you think?
Well, the problem with Brazil is because of those taxes, a lot of shoppers go abroad, and so they go to Miami a lot. You know, you can ask Saks or Neiman Marcus. But, you know, the reality of it is that it's not even just the Brazilians, but for a lot of newly affluent shoppers in these countries, it's fun to go shopping. And you want to say that you got that Louis Vuitton bag in London or in New York. It's more fun than to say that you bought it in your home city. And really, in a way, with all the craziness we've had with the stock market and the questions about Wall Street bonuses, the retail chains in the U.S. are really looking to overseas tourists to help them mitigate that risk.
You mentioned bonuses. It's obviously been a big thing both in the U.S. and the U.K. that when it comes to bonus season, that's then, you know, the luxury goods sector does particularly well. But obviously over the last 2 or 3 years, people have been a little bit shyer about boasting about their bonuses. Have you seen any real change in actual spending when it comes to bonus season?
Last year was up. Despite the fact that bonuses were down, and a lot of people say even the affluent have pent-up demand. I guess if you couldn't buy your Lamborghini in 08 or 09, you bought it in 2010. But, you know, there is a correlation. It's not enormous. It's been mitigated partly by international tourism. And frankly, here in New York, there is so much old money and deep wealth that, you know, it will hurt if the bonuses are smaller, but it won't decimate luxury.
And obviously people, going back to the visa waiver story, people are lobbying for this. Do you see a future in it? Do you see China, Russia and Brazil being included in the visa exemptions?
I'm not sure, but when we did speak to the government to get their comments in May, they said that the rules were there for a reason. So we'll see.
Hmm. And then quickly, finally, I know it's something you've been working on today. There's trouble at one of those most iconic of New York brands, at Tiffany's.
Well, their problem is that their sales are still growing gangbusters, but a little bit more slowly. And they did talk about weakness in Europe and in the eastern part of the U.S., which is the first time we've sort of seen a retailer acknowledge that, you know, things might be slowing down. It just seemed that luxury sales were impervious to the headlines for the last few months. And this is the first sign that it could be having an impact. And you saw their shares fell 10%. So the market took notice.
So it's that first ripple from the Eurozone. Is that what it feels like?
And also here, you know, where we like to talk about the Eurozone, but they haven't been able to reach a deal on the debt here. So, you know, it's not peachy here either.
No, and everyone likes to talk about other countries' crises to make theirs sound not quite so bad.
Absolutely.
Indeed. Okay, Phil Wilber from Reuters, thank you very much for joining us today. You're listening to a special edition of Midori House live from New York. This is the rather brilliant version of I'll Take Care of You by Jill Scott Heron and Jamie XX.
That was I'll Take Care of You by the late, great Gil Scott-Heron and Jamie XX. You're back with Midori House with me, Jonathan Openshaw, and Steve Bloomfield.
And now for our report from last night's Denmark survey launch event in Washington, D.C., held in the remarkable modernist monument that is the Danish Embassy. Amongst much clinking of glasses and noshing of new Nordic canapes, Jonathan and our New York editor Aisha Spears cornered a couple of Denmark's leading luminaries in the States. That's the ambassador to Washington, Peter Taxo Jensen, and the honorary vice consul to Houston, Texas, Anna Thompson Holliday. They talked about Denmark's changing role in the world and where it should be heading in the future.
Well, my name is Peter Taxo Jensen. I'm the Danish ambassador to the United States. I've been here since September of last year. I think Denmark has a good reputation, a good branding in the U.S. The problem is that we have a brand which is Hans Christian Andersen, The Little Mermaid, Tivoli and stuff, but that's sort of only tourism, and we want to show the world that we're much more than that, and therefore we are trying to move into climate change and the fact that we are sort of coping with the global economic challenges. We're trying to step up our labor force and focus on well, the future in terms of clean tech and stuff. And I think we are working quite well on that. But it is a challenge to sort of move away from this old image of sort of this very nice agricultural country where people bike around and you have The Little Mermaid and Hans Christian Andersen, and it's a fairy tale, to something that also shows the cutting edge things that we can do in Denmark. We're working hard to do that every day here.
I'm interested in Denmark's role culturally and socially within Scandinavia, but also within the broader Nordic region. So if we look at something like film, for example, the work of places like Zentropa and Lars von Trier really galvanized the movement within Denmark, certainly that's exported Denmark abroad, but also worked within a Scandinavian movement, and now we see with Swedish cinema and a much broader thing going on. Are you consciously working with through cultural programmes to create this sense of a Scandinavian cultural entity, or it'd be interesting to hear a bit more about how you approach that?
I mean, if you go to Sweden or Norway, they will think of Danes and Denmark as part of the continent, and we are sort of consider ourselves a little bit the bridgehead from Scandinavia to the continent. Film is one good example of where we have moved a lot over the last 15 years. We have to recognize that Sweden was actually way ahead of us with their tradition in movies. But we have sort of caught up with new generations of directors who have done a great job. We had an Oscar-winning film, I think, last year, and there's a lot of interest in that. So that, of course, is an agenda on the cultural side that we can push a lot. Another area which is very, very interesting and moving very high up the agenda is the whole Nordic cuisine thing. Just a couple of weeks ago, together with the other Nordic embassies, we arranged to serve dishes for all the school kids in DC schools. I think we served 55,000 meals in one day, just to give the kids here an impression of how is a different meal, and maybe also try to influence their nutrition by giving another example. So we're working on these areas where we think we have an edge on food, on film, and maybe also on some of the arts. And as I've said before, Scandinavian or Danish design is still something that really sticks out when you see different design types. And that's also easy to promote because people love it when you see it.
What's, I guess, the most un-Danish thing that you want to promote to America that people don't really realize is Danish? Because we know about Scandinavian design, we know about Danish design. Danish food, as you say, is getting much more of a kind of recognition. What's the hardest thing to promote?
If I tell Americans that, for instance, 17% of all goods are transported by Danish carriers, people are very surprised. And this is, of course, because we have the largest shipping company in the world, Maersk, but a lot of other Danish companies is also competing very well to be part of that. And then, for instance, when it comes to sea transport to the American Army or Defense Forces, I think 35% of that is done by Danish carriers as well. So that's something that people don't realize, and it's really something significant for a country where we are, have to say, only 5.5 million people.
I am Anna Thompson-Holliday, and I am the Honorary Vice Consul of Denmark in Houston, Texas.
Tell us a little bit about how Denmark is perceived in Houston, Texas.
Denmark is perceived as very innovative. Once people get over the fact that when I first came to Houston, people thought, they said Denmark, they say, oh, Amsterdam, you know. People didn't quite have an idea of where Denmark is. However, that has changed greatly over the last 20 years since I first came to Houston. And now Houston have a lot of international people with the oil companies. And there is a school that has 20 Danish families with their children there. So they feel that they're half Danish. I often go out there and lecture about Denmark. So perception has changed a lot.
The ambassador obviously reminded us of the importance of Danish shipping worldwide, and Dansk being a huge company. How does that work with Houston? Houston does a lot of trade and huge amounts of oil. How are those relationships built?
Well, Houston has I believe it's the third largest port in America, and where you have water, obviously you will have Danes. Danes are attracted to water. You know, we are a nation of islands and a big peninsula, and that's what we have. We have more than 400 islands, so we are very well versed in water, and we have seafaring is a tradition for Danes, and commerce. And in Houston, we have a lot of all the big shipping companies are present, Maersk Line, Nordana Line, Clipper. We have all of those, plus we have a lot of independent people in shipping and a lot of Danes just working in the shipping industry. And Danes are just masters of logistics. That seem to be what we have to do with intellectual capital. You know, it's a small country. We don't have any raw materials. We have a little bit of oil off of the North Sea, but that will eventually run out. So our biggest force as a people is the intellectual capital that we have.
It's an interesting and perhaps unusual relationship for many of our listeners between Houston and Copenhagen. So what are the eyes on the future? How do you want to see bilateral relations evolving over the next 5 years?
I would like to create stronger ties between Denmark and Houston, and I think our steps to open the Chamber of Commerce will help that. And I'd like to see trade delegations go to Houston. Our mayor often goes out, and our Greater Houston Convention Bureau and their trade office go out on trade missions. And I'd like to see more trade going on and raise the awareness of Denmark. It's pretty high, but, you know, it could be better. It would be nice to have some bilateral trade missions and the cultural exchange programs. And also with the universities, we have exchange programs with two of the universities in Houston, with South Texas College of Law and University of Houston. And I've just been to a meeting at Rice University, which is another major education institution in Houston, and we're trying to get exchange programs. And I think through education is a great way for the future generations. And I think with the young people, if you do exchange programs of learning with young people, that's a great way to further ties and further bonds between the two places.
That report was produced by Barra Austin, and the voices you heard were Peter Taxo Jensen and Anna Thompson Holiday, as well as Jonathan Openshaw's voice and Aisha's.
And you were complaining about the length of my questions there, Steve.
Well, they were quite long. They're very
probing.
Detailed. Yes, very, very detailed, probing questions. I'm surprised. I'm very grateful for the fact that you managed to hold that all together last night.
I know. Took 20 minutes out of my party time.
It did.
But they were great. They were both great interviewees. I loved doing the interview with Anna Thompson Holiday, especially because we did that in the Royal Apartments at the embassy.
Oh, really?
So the apartments that the Crown Prince couple had recently stayed in on their trip to Washington, and there was some speculation by the Denmark embassy that the timing of the Crown Princess's pregnancy might have been there. So
oh, really? They're allowed to speculate about things like that.
Maybe not.
There were also some quite amazing Andy Warhols there as well, weren't there?
Oh my, incredible!
Of Queen Elizabeth, which I think had been when she'd come to visit. Recently,
I think so.
And not only that, but they'd also they'd had them sent over from Denmark by a private collector in Denmark, as well as one of the only remaining Arne Jacobsen egg sofas, which was sort of behind like a little barrier. You couldn't go and sit on it.
Did you vault the barrier at the end of the evening?
I was slightly tempted to.
I think it was one of how many?
There were only eight that were ever
eight
made,
in the world.
And this is the only one that anyone knows where it actually is. So incredible. The other seven might be in private collections or might just be. Yeah, maybe one's like gathering dust in a garage in Brixton or something. And
time to check the attic.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
But no, an incredible one, surrounded by photos from the SAS Radisson in Copenhagen, where they've got that room, actually, the Arne Jacobsen room. I think it's room 606, which is still untouched from the early days. Just kind of beautiful, the original egg chairs and everything there. So I think you, by special request, you can go. And our design editor Hugo's done.
It is quite stunning. We're going to be having another event as well in New York tonight for various subscribers, Monocle subscribers. So if you are one of those people, we'll hopefully see you there. But that is it for this Tuesday edition of Midori House here at Argo Studios in New York. Today's show was produced by Dawn Trump in London and Aisha Spears in New York. Our researchers were Tom Hall in London and Barrett Austin in New York. And our studio manager was Alex Funnell in London, and Noriko Akabe here in New York at the Argo Studios. And there was also some other guy, Andrew Tuck, who was sort of through the glass, trying to be helpful every now and then. Anyway, that's the end of our brief East Coast sojourn. Tomorrow's Midori House will be back in Midori House itself at 2200 hours London time tonight. Our colleagues will be back with the Monocle Daily. Till then, we'll be playing you out with Autumn in New York by Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong. For now, from all of us here at Monocle 24, goodbye.
Why does it seem